Now, news from the Department of Mixological Legislation. On Monday, the Louisiana legislature voted the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of the city of New Orleans. Earlier attempts to make the Sazerac the state cocktail failed in the lower house. Official cocktails aren't entirely unprecedented. A few years ago, Finlandia Vodka created the Flightless Finn, a kiwi fruit-based lime fusion vodka martini, which was to be the official cocktail of the Air New Zealand Fashion Week. This, of course, is much bigger than that, and the Sazerac isn't some drink just cooked up for a promotion scheme. It is a venerable mix of rye and bitters and other stuff cooked up by a Creole apothecary in the antebellum French Quarter. And it's still big at the Swizzle Stick Bar, where Lou Brow is the bar chef, and she joins us from New Orleans. Welcome to the program, Lou.
Hello, how are you today? Glad to be here.
Fine, and joining me in the studio is a member of our staff, appearing incognito, who will perform the role of bar sous chef. He's going to actually make the drink, okay?
Okay.
Tell us about a Sazerac and what's so good about it.
Well, I can't begin to tell you how excited I am that it's our city's official cocktail. I don't know of another city in the United States that has an official cocktail, and if there was ever a city that needed one, it's New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the most interesting thing about the Sazerac cocktail are the bitters. The bitters are Peychaud's bitters. Antoine Amédée Peychaud was a Creole immigrant, and he arrived in New Orleans in about 1795. He was a pharmacist, and he ran an apothecary on Royal Street. And at night, he would blend brandy and his secret recipe for his bitters together, and he would serve this to gentlemen.
And in addition to those bitters, what else is in this drink?
Well, let's start from the top. We're going to have two rocks glasses.
All right, we've got the two rocks glasses.
We're going to take absinthe.
I think we're going to use a substitute.
You're going to use herbsane or Pernod, or what do you have today?
We're going to use herbsane as a substitute for the absinthe.
Just take a bit of it, about a bar teaspoonful.
Mm-hmm.
Pour it into an empty rocks glass that's at room temperature. And you're going to swirl that around.
I really want you
to swirl it around. It's got thick legs on it. Take the remnants of that, and you're going to toss it out into your waste area.
Wait a minute. We're tossing out what part here?
You're tossing out the herbsane.
I see. Okay. We're just coating the glass with that right now.
That's it. You're just coating it. It's actually just a rinse. And now take that glass and fill it with ice.
Fill it with ice. Okay.
And just set it to the side. So now take your shaker.
Mm-hmm.
Since you've already gone one step ahead and
right.
and made simple syrup, put it in your mixer glass.
Mm-hmm.
Add your good drops of your Peychaud's bitters.
We've done that.
Now we're going to add 2 ounces of rye whiskey. There's several brands out there. Take 2 ounces of that and put that in your mixing glass with your sugar that has the bitters.
2 ounces of the rye whiskey going into the mixing glass. Okay, we're all in.
Okay, now we're going to add ice to that mixture. So we want to leave a lot of room at the top so that spoon can move.
What happened to the Angostura? Lost that.
We'll use 1 drop of Angostura bitters.
I think we've got everything in the shaker now.
Okay. Stir quickly.
This is stirred, not shaken.
Stirred, not shaken. We're going to stir that up really briskly. We want to get a lot of motion going on that. That sounds wonderful. And what we're going to do is really, really chill that mixture. There we go. Now we're going to take the spoon out. We're going to use a strainer. Take the glass that you put to the side with the ice in it. And now you're going to toss that ice out so your glass is really cold.
We've made quite a drink just in the garbage so far, but we've thrown it out.
And what you'll do is strain that mixture that you just stirred into that chilled rocks glass that was rinsed with the herbsane.
Mm.
And now we'll take that beautiful twist of lemon and twist it so that all that oil comes out of the lemon peel and just run it around the inside rim of that glass and then drop it in quickly.
All right, and there it goes. And voila.
Now it's time to take a sip.
Okay. Thank you. I'm being handed this remarkably chilled drink. Mmm. Tastes like we're in New Orleans right now.
Oh, that's awesome.
It is the official drink of New Orleans at this point.
It is the official drink of New Orleans.
Louisiana
Cheers.
Legislature. What about the hurricane? What about those, you know, drinks they make and the things that look like a laundrette?
Well, you know, we do have other drinks in New Orleans. We have hurricanes as well. We also have a lot of mint juleps that are served here in the city. Ramos Gin Fizz.
Yes. It's a very complex taste that you get from this drink after all those bitters and the rye and the lemon and all.
It is a beautiful example of a good cocktail.
And at the Swizzle Stick Bar, after how many do you usually cut people off?
Well, it's really funny that you should mention that because T. Martin, one of the managing directors of our restaurant bar, has a quote that you should only enjoy one. You're not nearly as attractive as you think you are after two. So you have to remember that you are drinking a real cocktail and not one with a lot of mixers in it, and it's one that you should enjoy responsibly.
Well, Lou Brow, thank you very much for
thank you.
Teaching us how to make one.
Awesome.
And thanks to our mystery guest for making one here in the studio. We've been talking about the official cocktail of the city of New Orleans, the Sazerac, with Lou Brow, who is the bar chef at the Swizzle Stick Bar in New Orleans. If your town has an official drink or should have one, drop us a line. Alcoholic or not, we want to hear about your local beverage of choice. Better yet, we want the recipe. Just go to npr.org and click on Contact Us, and be sure to put the word drink in your message line. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today, Hidden Kitchens explores communal urban gardens. The Kitchen Sisters and Roman Mars present Garden Allotments, a London kitchen vision.
Apple tree there, blackcurrant bushes, and a blueberry in the corner, onions and shallots. I'm Charlie Gregory, Fitzroy Park Allotment. Out in the fresh air. Everybody knows everybody, you know. So it's not expensive. For £27 a year, and you've got this piece of land in this beautiful spot. I'm a bachelor myself, but I'm 78 now. If you want to keep fit and live to a good old age, get an allotment.
I'm Oliver Rowe, Constant Restaurant, London. Anywhere there's a bit of unused green space has the potential to be turned into allotment. On the edge of a railway siding, squeezed in a patch of disused land, give people a bit of extra fresh veg.
Allotments started in the 19th century. Everyone was getting rickets and stuff like this in the Industrial Revolution. London was, as we all know from Dickens, a terrifying place. So as people fled from agrarian poverty into the city, land was given in perpetuity for people to cultivate vegetables. First and Second World Wars, we had the dig for victory. The allotment boom really happened in 1940s, 1950s. And my name's John Kelly, and I acquired an allotment in North London, beyond Muswell Hill, where the Kinks used to come from. There were most definitely different communities. Polish people, the Italian guy opposite me was fixated on growing Tuscan grapes for wine. Posh English ladies creating conceptual arts. And you'd see these scarecrows, your hand-me-down Versace. In our particular case, everyone had taken a pledge to be organic. If anybody dared to use a rotavator, even by night, by stealth, there would be consequences.
Colour in sky, brush and blue, scarlet fleece changes hue.
I'm Julie Sumner from Manor Garden Allotments in the East End of London. You'd go past rambling old factories and down a little alleyway, lots of rubbish everywhere. You'd open the gate, and there in front of you would be a little single-track bridge crossing the River Lee. The slopes of the side of the river covered in plum trees.
That place is, I tell you, a dream place. Like we was living in heaven. My name is Hassan Ali. 1968, I left Cyprus. I come here. Turkish, Greek, English, Irish. We was all friends. I always cook every day something. My friend Reggie, 17 years, I know him. Every day we together. And he brings something from his garden, I bring something, we cook and eat there, me and Rich.
Hassan had the most beautiful shed. His shed was built so it had a covered area, so even though it was teeming with rain, he could still have friends round for lunch. Wonderful sort of bean dishes with slow-cooked lamb and sorrel. My name's Sam Clark, Morrow Restaurant.
I mean, an Englishman's home is his castle, and an allotment owner's home is their shed. The shed is a mirror of British society. And there's an Irish guy, when you got into his shed, it was Old Ireland. He had John F. Kennedy, Pope John the 23rd, and Jesus in there, assembled in the shed.
The person who set up Manor Garden Allotments was Major Arthur Villiers. He was so appalled by the treatment of working class people during the First World War that he devoted his life to providing facilities for the poorest of the poor over in the East End. They built squash courts, swimming pools, cricket grounds. Major Villiers thought these kids need to be eating good food, so let's create some allotments for the parents to produce the food on. Always said to the people who he gave the allotments to, these are going to be yours in perpetuity when I'm gone.
The International Olympic Committee has the honour of announcing that the Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
We heard the announcement, London, and it was just stunned, numb silence up at the allotments. We realised that we were going to be somewhere in this proposed Olympic development. We had a great hope they would be inspired by the idea of including allotments in the Olympic Park and having it as a showcase worldwide for food growing and community and sustainable use of land. But in October 2007, they bulldozed us. Where Manor Garden Allotments was is going to be a footpath.
I'm not against the Olympic, but the worst thing they done to us, they take the garden and they give us another place which is not garden. The soil is no good there. It's always flooding. You can't grow nothing.
Regardless of the 2012 Olympics, other allotments are under threat now because it's become desirable building land. Now I'm afraid the allotments have been turned into a bit of a bidding war. In the past, the allotment thing was sacred.
This is our new allotment, Marsh Lane. Welcome to the swamp. Let me take you down. I'm an optimist, so I'm going to shove in these potatoes and we'll see what happens. The only real reason I'm staying on here is not for the vegetables anymore, it's more for the community. And they said after the Olympics, in 6 years' time, you can go back to where you were. But you know, if one's honest, and a third of the people on the allotment are going to be too old to move back to the new site. They're going to have to live out their gardening years on this bog. Danger of sinking. We've had some of the old guys go merrily into their plot and then they get stuck. And you see these poor guys waving. So you've got to have an old people check before you leave. Otherwise they get locked in and they get found the next day. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going
to Strawberry Fields. After the Games, the Manor Garden Allotment Society will move to a site within Olympic Park. Hidden Kitchens is produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, and mixed by Jim McKee.
Support for NPR comes from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont at cabotcheese.coop.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Monte. Nothing to get hung about.
Strawberry fields forever. There is a pretty intense public policy debate brewing. Perhaps you've heard about it. A lot of people want access to a certain substance, but the laws make it difficult or impossible to get it in many places. These people say the stuff is good for them, but the U.S. government says it's dangerous. So in many places, people have set up a black market delivery system to get their hands on the goods. They favor full legalization, but some suppliers are being raided and arrested. As you probably guessed, we are talking about milk. Raw, unpasteurized milk. BPP producer Dan Pashman has been looking into this issue. He and Wynn Rosenfeld have a video report up on our website today. And Jan, I just decided to call you.
That's cool. I'm flexible. Whatever you...
Dan hey. Joins us now in the studio. Hey, Dan.
How are you?
We're doing well. So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, why do people want raw milk? I hear that and I kind of think that sounds gross. Why do people want this?
Well, the idea is, you know, we've been pasteurizing milk for many decades. And the idea of pasteurization is that you heat the milk in order to kill potentially dangerous pathogens that could be inside the milk. But proponents of raw milk, they believe that when you're doing that, when you're killing the potentially bad stuff, that you're also killing good stuff that can provide a wide range of health benefits. The main ones are, they say that it helps your immune system to be exposed to these different kinds of bacteria. They argue that people who are lactose intolerant can drink raw milk, whereas they may not be able to drink pasteurized milk. And there's a whole other list. They say it gives you better energy, better mental health, and the list goes on and on from there. But
X-ray vision, invisibility.
That's right. Yet to be proven. But
so how do you procure this stuff? I mean, well, you said in the intro, it's kind of regulated. It's hard to get your hands on.
It is. It really depends on what state you live in. The laws vary widely. There are 8 states where you can actually buy raw milk in the store. You can just go to the store and buy raw milk, although it has to be marked clearly. There are a bunch of other states where you can only buy raw milk at the farm where the cows are being milked. It can't be taken off-site and sold elsewhere. Then there's even a couple of states like Florida where it can only be sold as pet food. But a lot of people just buy it, marked as pet food, and then they go home and drink it themselves.
Do they have to, like, go in and bark at the clerk right. selling it to you?
Yeah, they have to prove that you have a dog.
Oh, okay.
No, you don't.
Are a dog.
and then even in a few other states where it's technically illegal, they still don't stop people from drinking the milk raw from their own cows if they own the cows. Mm-hmm. And so some farmers have taken to selling cow shares. So you actually buy a share of a cow, so you are ostensibly an owner of the cow, and then you can go to that farm and pick up your, quote-unquote, your milk.
Wow. So, I mean, people are going to such lengths because of the benefits that you mentioned, supposedly boosting your immune system, it helps if you're lactose intolerant. Is there any science to back up those claims?
Well, there's some.
I mean, you can find science to back up anything, I suppose.
Right. I mean, there's been a few recent interesting studies done. One was done out of in Switzerland. They had a study of 15,000 European kids. And they found that kids who drank raw milk had lower incidence of asthma and allergies, which is pretty interesting. It was especially interesting that the earlier they started drinking the raw milk, the better the benefits, the more the benefits that they saw were. Hmm. There's also a study done that was funded by the Weston A. Price Foundation, which is an activist group in favor of raw milk, but they did an independent study which suggested that people who are lactose intolerant are more likely to be able to drink raw milk. The problem with these studies is that they don't isolate raw milk as the determining factor.
Yeah, because I imagine it's a self-selecting group that's drinking this stuff. They're probably eating really healthy anyway.
Right. They also eat. There's differences in what they eat. There are differences in where they live. There are a variety of differences. So it's very difficult, scientists say, to point to raw milk as the deciding right. factor that has brought these health benefits.
Like that Swiss study, it's probably the raw milk kids were also the macrobiotic food kids and the eat your vegetables kids and the not just eating, you know, Fritos all day kids.
Right. And they were also oftentimes kids who grew up on farms. So they were exposed to bacteria by being around animals,
right.
which is another way you can build your immune system besides just drinking raw milk.
So let's talk about the other side of this. The government says this stuff is bad for us, right? Explain. What
they
are the fears?
The Food and Drug Administration actually declined to be interviewed for our story, but they have a PowerPoint presentation on their website that leaves no questions about where they stand. They call raw milk inherently dangerous.
Huh.
Why? Well, because there have been outbreaks. There have been people who've gotten sick from drinking raw milk. Things like salmonella, brucellosis, listeria, these things can be found in raw milk. And milk that hasn't been pasteurized, they say, is more likely to make you sick. And they say that it's dangerous. So they favor not allowing it at all. So it's pretty much polar opposites in terms of that. The FDA has this PowerPoint presentation. There's actually a dueling PowerPoint presentation war on the internet. The Weston A. Price Foundation, they have a rebuttal, slide-by-slide rebuttal to that PowerPoint on their website. We've got links to all this up on our web.
Slide-by-slide throwdown.
That's right.
So there are some claims that there's food poisoning that can be connected to raw milk. What do raw milk drinkers want to happen? Are they satisfied with having to go to these extremes to get the milk, or are they urging a more open marketplace for this?
Well, they, you know, it varies a bit. It should be said that very few of them favor an end to pasteurization. They just want to be able to make the choice for themselves. And now some of them feel that raw milk should just be available in the stores like it is in those eight states. You should just be able to go and buy it. A lot of the other ones actually like the system that's the middle ground sort of approach, which is like we have here in New York State, which is that system where it can only be sold at the farm and you need a special permit. And that allows consumers to go to the farm, see where the raw milk is being made. And a lot of them argue that it comes down to the difference between big farms and small farms, and that the FDA's approach is sort of an old school big milk industry approach of, well, this needs to be regulated because we can't keep tabs on all these things. And they say, well, at a small enough farm, if you have a farmer who really takes care of his or her milk, then you can actually ensure that raw milk will be safe.
And you and Wynn visited one of these really small farms.
We did. We went up to Freedom Hill Farm in Otisville, New York. It's about 90 miles northwest of here. We spoke to Rick and Julie Vreeland, who started selling milk as a hobby and ended up getting so many demands for raw milk. Rick said that it was like they put a sign outside that said free drugs for addicts.
That's crazy.
Last summer, they started selling raw milk. They sold 13 gallons in the first month. This past month, they sold more than 1,000 gallons.
Wow.
And Rick is perfectly qualified to talk about big farm versus small farm because he used to run a farm with 2,000 cows. And he flat out said he didn't drink the milk raw from that old farm because he wasn't the one milking the cows. The cows are getting milked at 2 in the morning while he's sleeping. So an honest mistake could be made and something could get into the milk and it could be a very dangerous honest mistake.
So there's a lot of trust that's involved in this process too. The people who are taking this unpasteurized milk from these farmers, I mean, they're just trusting them that they're handling it well.
They are, but they're also taking a lot of initiative on their own to go to the farm. And that's one of the things that the consumers at this farm in New York State that we talked to said, we like that we can come here and we know Rick and Julie. We know the people. We can look at the cows. We can watch them milk the cows. And so we can see for ourselves that the milk is being handled properly.
Is it your impression that even the most radical pro raw milk people don't say, oh, there's nothing to worry about, just put it on the shelves next to the regular milk? Or even the people who are the biggest pro raw milk people, do they say things like, you still have to be careful, you still have to know where it's coming from, let's be cautious about this?
I'm sure you could find a couple of people on the far end. But in general, they do favor standards specifically for raw milk because one of the arguments that they make is that they believe that at bigger factory farms, basically the farmers take pasteurization for granted and just assume they can let whatever they want get into the milk and they can have low standards because pasteurization will take care of it after the fact.
Two more questions. First, did you ever taste this stuff?
I did, and I must say it was delicious.
Seriously?
It was. It was creamier than any other milk, creamier and richer than any other milk. And it backs up the idea that, I mean, pasteurization has been fine-tuned. The process has been to find a balance between safety and flavor. You don't want to sterilize the milk because then it loses flavor. And there was a whole lot of flavor in the raw milk.
But I can't, milk flavor. I don't know if I want more milkiness in my mouth. Anyway, the last question.
Yeah. There
was
You're
so
just afraid of the milkiness. You don't know what milkiness can mean
not.
To you.
I guess not. There was so much science, really interesting stuff that you learned out of this. Tell us about some of the things that surprised you.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that didn't fit into the video, but I found super interesting. One is that we're learning more and more that bacteria plays a more integral role in human life and the human immune system than we previously knew.
Because we think bacteria, we think bad.
Right. You see those commercials for antibacterial soaps, and you see these cartoons
like
of
creatures,
big evil
monsters.
Yeah. Right.
They look like the cavity creeps from Crest commercials.
Right.
A little bit.
And the truth is that a lot of while probably more bacteria are bad than good, there are a lot of good bacteria out there. And one of the most interesting things I learned is about this stuff called oligosaccharides. It's a sugar that is in human breast milk. And it goes, the baby gets it from the mother, but the baby cannot digest oligosaccharides. So you would say, why after millions of years of evolution is the mother still producing it?
Yeah.
Well, that's because oligosaccharides are essentially bacteria food for good bacteria. They are a food that goes into the baby and creates a breeding ground for good bacteria to help the baby ward off bad bacteria.
I never knew that.
And one of the scientists I spoke to, Bruce German, he said that down the road we're going to industrialize good bacteria and that instead of having antibacterial sprays for your countertops, you're going to have sprays with good bacteria and you're going to spread good bacteria on your countertops to get rid of the bad bacteria.
Totally fascinating. It's a great video report. Go check it out online at npr.org/Brian Park. Thank you, Dan Pashman.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Fascinating stuff. Right. Participate in the online discussion as well.
Yeah. for Kitchen Window. This is Bonnie Wolf. Julie O'Hara is a freelance writer and recipe developer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she blogs at A Mingling of Tastes. She has her own answer to the breakfast question and has written about it. She joins me today. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Your solution is quick bread, right?
Absolutely, quick bread.
Explain what a quick bread is.
Sure. A quick bread is a bread that gets its rise from baking powder or baking soda or eggs as opposed to yeast. And it requires no rising time as a yeast bread does. So it's quick.
Give me some examples.
Let's see, scones, muffins, those are quick breads. Most of the time, a quick bread is made really simply just by combining all your dry ingredients and all your wet ingredients and mixing them up. So anything that falls into that category, cornbread, banana bread, you know, loaves like that, anything where you're not working with yeast, you're not dealing with rising and proofing and any of that business.
That would be a long bread.
Exactly.
A not quick bread. And when you write about quick breads, you say there are three basic principles. What are they?
Okay, the first one is to measure your flour correctly, next to mix with a light hand, and finally, be careful not to overbake. So with flour, you want to make sure you measure the flour as the writer did when they were testing the recipes for the book. But the standard way is to fluff up your flour, spoon it into a measuring cup, being careful not to shake the cup so the flour doesn't settle, and then just level it off with a knife. And that'll ensure that you get the right amount of flour. If you have too much flour, you're going to have a dried out muffin or scone. With mixing, this is probably the most important thing about quick breads. Remember that they're quick. You want to be in and out. You add the wet ingredients to the dry ingredients, mix it up just until the flour is barely moistened, and you're done. That's all it takes. It doesn't have to be perfect. If you see a couple specks of flour, no big deal. You're better off that way as opposed to having a tougher dough in the end. And the last one, this kind of comes down to the vagaries of your own kitchen. Obviously, you don't want to overbake muffins or scones. You want them to be golden brown and perfect. But all ovens are different. So just be vigilant. Check them a couple minutes before the baking time. And once you try a recipe, the more you do it, you'll know what to look for, and you're good.
Now, why do you think quick breads are the solution to what to have for breakfast?
Well, I have a sweet tooth for breakfast. And so, first of all, that satisfies that sweet craving for breakfast. But more than that, they travel well, and they're satisfying. And you don't want to have to find that you're starving on your way to work, during your commute, on your way to class, and have to go into that donut shop or that expensive coffee bar and buy a 500-calorie muffin that's not going to taste good, that's not going to feel good, and that's going to make a mess all over your business suit.
But these are not 500-calorie muffins.
No, they're not. And that's the thing. When you make your own quick breads at home, you can add a few extra nutrients. You can use the whole wheat flour or the white whole wheat flour if you don't like the look of regular whole wheat. You can add heart-healthy nuts. Those are great. You can add flaxseed. You can add fruit. And so you know what you're getting. You know what's in there, and you know it's nutritious. I mean, sure, there's still sugar, and, you know, there's still butter, but for the most part, it's a pretty solid, nutritious, satisfying meal.
White whole wheat flour is what?
It is a particular type of wheat. It's grown in Kansas, actually. It's a soft white wheat. And so it's not bleached. It's naturally pale in color. And it still contains the bran and the germ, like whole wheat flour does. And that's the part of the wheat that adds the fiber and the nutrients. So it still has the fiber and nutrients, but it's a lighter color, and it behaves a lot like all-purpose flour. So it's totally natural. It's not bleached or anything like that. And you still get the fiber and nutrients with a lighter taste, a lighter texture. It has kind of a sweet flavor that really does mimic all-purpose flour.
Is it easily available?
It is, especially more and more. The brand that I use is King Arthur, and that's available in health food stores and some supermarkets even. You can order it online. I think, you know, if you seek it out, you should be able to find it.
You suggest making a lot of these in advance and freezing them.
Yeah, you can absolutely do that. I mean, it sounds like, you know, oh, it's not as good as homemade. Why bother? It's not fresh from the oven. That is totally not true. I just live with my husband, so the two of us can't eat a batch of muffins, you know, in one shot. So I freeze them, and you pull them out a couple hours before you want to eat, or you leave them in the fridge overnight. They defrost. They taste as fresh as the day you made them. I mean, that's what the freezer is good for. It's a great way to save time and to get it done in advance.
Could you make the batter in advance and refrigerate it and make the muffin in the morning fresh?
I personally wouldn't do that, and I think there are some recipes that are developed for that purpose. So if you have a cookbook that says you can do that, you can do it. But the problem is that as soon as the leavening agents, the baking powder, as soon as it comes into contact with the liquid, it starts to react. So if it's reacting all night as it sits in the fridge, by the time you bake it, it won't create the rise in the muffins or the scones or whatever you're making.
Right.
But what you could do is you could mix up all the dry ingredients and, you know, chop your fruit, chop up your nuts, and then just combine it all in the morning. And that really only takes a few minutes. I do that sometimes because it, you know, it's kind of a dull process to measure all the flour and stuff, and that takes time. So I like doing that in advance.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had oatmeal, and I'm a big oatmeal girl with bananas, and I had one of my mango muffins because I have a freezer absolutely full of muffins from testing all these recipes. So I know that they work, and I'm still eating all the evidence.
Julie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.